the fruit. Be fruitful and multiply. And Shabbat is quite strong.
Oh, I'll be it here.
Ah, right here, in the middle of my attendance papers. I should pass it around. Well, maybe before I start, if you don't go over this list, what are we talking about? I did a total of near each other, so it's considered a terrible cause. Ah, it's right here, in the middle of my attendance papers. I should pass it around. Cause of evil thoughts, and that's why the Sefer Hasidim said what he said. But nowadays, he claims that there is common for men together to interact with each other, so it would not be considered to be a violation of the laws of Tzniyus, it wouldn't cause any bad thoughts, and therefore you can take Hasidim from alone. That's a very important Levush, because that is relevant to so many things we spoke about. And I kept introducing the element of subjectivity. It depends upon the circumstance, upon the society, upon the time and the place. As an example, we spoke about in terms of clothing and, you know, dress, etc. He took Mixini and said it depends upon the time and the place. We spoke about, remember, women speaking in front of men, we spoke about that. I'm like, what are you talking about? No. That's being real. Can do the whole fight recently. One of the organizations, the Jewish organizations, was criticizing how can a woman get up and speak in front of men? It's terrible. And yet the people from that same organization do it all the time. Just not all the time, but if you go, for example, to a graduation of an all girls school. So in the Hasidic circles, I guess the only females are invited to the graduation. They have no graduation. But if you're not in the Hasidic circles and you're in a graduation of a girls' school, so the women speak in front of the men, the fathers, the brothers, the neighbors come. And then the lady gets up and starts to speak and speak and speak. Somebody wishes she'd stop speaking. But they keep speaking. So what happened to this outrage? How can a woman speak in front of men? The answer is it's all contextual. It's understood if it's a graduation of a woman's school, you can't have men speaking. You see, I have all men speaking. That would be crazy. So too, in different societies, it's accepted all the time that women speak in front of men. In classes, in shiurim. Sometimes it's at Levayis. Now I thought it's Lucrative Chassidus. I haven't been able to swallow that one too much yet, but maybe it'll change. So far, you know, I'm very conservative. Right? Things take a while till they grow on me. When I was a child at Levi's, I never heard of a woman speak, ever. Now that's becoming a little more common. Now maybe one day I'll get used to women speaking in Chassidus. So far I'm not. I think it's terrible so far. So, yeah. But again, it depends on the... To my mind, it's what's called preachers. I told you what preachers is. Changing the custom. So once the whole debate in the fence, it's been made already. So then the person who goes in is just following everybody else. Generally speaking, we speak about preachers. Remember the Das Yehudas we spoke about, the violation of the modest dress of the Jewish woman. So the Rosh explained that someone who violates the modest dress of the Jewish woman is suspected of immorality. That's how far it goes. Once you break the fence in one thing, then anything goes. You don't know what's going to happen. But if you're not breaking a fence, this is commonly done. I don't think it's considered to be in the category of preachers. It seems to me now that, let's say, by a funeral, so in many circles, it would be not acceptable for a woman to speak at a funeral. It would be unacceptable. Other circles, it's commonplace. What do you mean, why not? The women will go on here, women speak at all kinds of other functions, at shiurim, and at classes, and sure, and here and there, so it's really a matter of common, it's commonplace. So again, to my mind, all these things are really subjective and contextual. And in some cases, it would be paritzus, in other cases, it would not. Mechitza. Years gone by, no one had a mechitza by a chasen. Didn't exist. I've been about to see them. What about the dancing? So he pointed out dancing on two separate sides, and the men weren't supposed to look at the woman, with the women. Some did, some didn't. Now the mechitza again, some do and some don't. So hopefully there are more that don't than do, because of the result of the mechitza. But the women dancing in a circle, not a mechitza in separate circles. Even with the mechitza in front of the band, and the photographer, and the video. Again, we spoke about this. Ideally, it shouldn't exist at all, but if it exists, I don't think it's a terrible thing to try to avoid it. I mentioned the distinction, it's not like a lifeguard. I'm very much opposed to a male lifeguard and women are swimming, because they're really not dressed. But when they're dancing, not so bad. So the band is supposed to be looking down at their notes, right? And the photographer is trying to focus, right? He's not trying to play with his gizmos there. And the video, I already told you, the video should be a lady video, like the chassidus should have videos. Or let the video be for the men's dancing. Because the problem of the video, you know, is even when it's shown later on. Okay, pretty different opinions. Mixed seating for singles is topic number four. Again, it all depends on the circumstances. When I grew up, I was regularly seated mixed for singles when my friends were getting married. To try to make shidduchim. I was once at a wedding of a close friend of mine. The chosn and the kala came over to our table in the middle, and they made a shidduch right in front of my eyes. I kid you not, right in front of my eyes. They made a shidduch. This young man, this young lady, boom, they got married. I'm a witness to it. I saw it happen. So is it obviously it's considered to be a positive phenomenon? I wasn't really comfortable with the whole idea. I mean, no one came to me when I was single. I think that most, I can't speak for the ladies, most of the men prefer sitting separate when they're single. I think so. Unless they feel that they can somehow be introduced to someone that's going to lead to a shidduch. Okay. So that would be the case. Then we could find a redeeming feature in it. Ordinarily, I would say it's not preferred. Next, our caucus between single men and single women, to what extent do we have to go? Our caucus means, who wrote the question? Who's willing to admit to it? What does our caucus mean? To stay far away from doing something wrong? Of course, you have to stay far. We spoke about yichud already. But even beyond yichud, you have to know how to speak and how to look and how to conduct yourself. You can't write a whole Shulchan Aruch about this. I think you understand yourself that someone is too forward deserves a slap across the face. And even though there's no yichud and there's no this and there's no that, someone speaks out of turn, looks out of turn, speaks out of turn, and conducts himself out of turn. Not right. Could be himself or herself. Someone's a woman could be very, very forward. Not right. Walking down the aisle at a wedding as a bridesmaid. Well, it's again the same story. It's a kind of contextual thing. And some people do it, some don't do it. I mean, at my wedding, it was done. It was done by relatives marked down. Now they have a friend. And this, now they print it up now. So now I have my son. It's printed. I don't think I didn't show up. I was at a wedding just last week. They printed it. It was the last time. And they printed up the... 2 weeks, whatever it was. They printed up the whole big program and then two people didn't show up. They were standing. So great. Yichud is a prayer. Problems that come up with kiruv between men and women. Oh, I wrote an article about that. I'm not sure if the article came out before or after question 8 was written. The article was attacked. I came out against the co-educational mode, unless it's absolutely necessary, because there's no choice. Some of that was a speech I gave, and was written in a publication called Hamavasa. You reached downtown yet? Do you stare at it? No?
Yeah.
There it is. Unless someone wrote a letter against me. Said, how can I say such a thing that it's not right? Who could have an extra statement? After all, there were co-ed high schools and schools, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was in favor of the co-ed high school, Maimonides, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm not getting involved in an argument with this person who wrote, it, but, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik's opinion is not so open and shut. As a matter of fact, his son-in-law, Rav Tversky, should be the Talmud Rebbe from Boston, was asked, you know, what's good with this co-ed, and Chassidim are not exactly in favor of co-ed. So how can you tell the Rebbe, what's your attitude, and how did your father, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what do you think about this? So his response was, there was no alternative. When Maimonides was founded in Boston 15 years ago, whatever it was, in the 1930s, when 60 years ago, when there was no Yiddishkeit at all, how did we found it? Things remain. Not that there, Rabbi Soloveitchik felt there should be no lechatchil. This is printed in a sefer called Nefesh Harav. Look it up if you want. So I thought that, I never discussed it myself personally with Rav Soloveitchik, but I didn't think that he was in favor of it. He certainly didn't write anything in favor of it. What he did in the school is a subject of different interpretations. It seems to be the interpretation of those in, for example, the son-in-law should be given great credence. So therefore, I don't mind being attacked. It's told to the turf. Some quote you in a newspaper, and a person has the right to argue. But I have a right to maintain my opinion, which I do. Alright? So, this is exactly question 8. They wrote the answer evidence here. So why then all this stuff in Akiva? So I already kind of the language that I had written there, but I basically said, well, look, if it serves a greater need, it's impossible to do otherwise. You have to weigh the benefits against the losses, but it's still considered a loss, not considered the ideal. And Rabbi Weinberg says already in his Sweet Aish, writing in the 1950s in Europe, they had the Akiva and other organizations. I remember even calling in the shiur that I gave at the time, a man named Rav Aviner. You hear him, Rav Aviner? From Beidel, from my Teret Kohanim. He himself is an alumnus of Bnei Akiva. And he writes in very strong terms that the idea of Kohen Bnei Akiva is not right. Yeah, they do a lot of good, and I was involved in it myself, etc., etc., etc. And I know it's in some circles, we can't help it. But that's not to say it's an ideal. That's not to say it's right. That's what I said. I'm not saying I'm not coming to close out all these organizations. I said, well, it's not, it really shouldn't be, it's really not right. Holy Shul spoke about Nagia. Nagia has been discussed. Necklines. Necklines over here. Good shirt. Okay, again, Nagia with your family. Dance, Megadish. Being. I need to work. I think it means wearing shorts, okay, the word I can't read, in front of other girls. Is that considered not sneeze, but in front of a brother? No. In front of other girls, I mean, people go swimming in front of other girls. They're wearing, nothing. So, there's not a contest of swimming, it's down just around, so it's better to dress in a more sneeze-like fashion. So, it's a brother. Strictly speaking, prohibition, but it's not right to do it that way. Like you just spoke about it. Handshaking with men. So we spoke about this, and so it should be avoided if it's at all possible. And if it's impossible to avoid it, so we can possibly say that it's the Giyah Shalom B'Derechiva, which, according to many authorities, is permissible. For Moshe, it's permissible, but he's not sure that the handshake, we discussed it, but sometimes when people shake hands in an affectionate manner. We even been making a mezuzah before Birkas HaMazon. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, but it's okay. The Vilna Gaon is a requirement. The custom is not to do it. But those who do it, I can't say it's prohibited. As long as they're doing it for the purpose of mitzvah, not just to prove a point, things of that nature. Women as dayanot. So we spoke in the first class about what we call sarara, that we call authority. A judge is a very great authority, therefore women should not be in that role. Women as rabbis, same story. The rabbin is a position of authority. As a result, women really should not fill that role. Could a woman rule on a halakhic question? Of course. When it's something which is, she knows about and she's competent, and someone asks her, so why not? But that doesn't mean she's a rabbi. Any person can answer a question. But the idea of authority, which is critical in the Rambanus, when there's one answer for everybody in the community, that's already authority. Yes?
I remember when I was in high school, when my Rabbanim mentioned that there was a woman studying the laws of Mizas, that she could pass some Shilas.
Right.
So I don't know specifically the situation, but with that...
Yeah, it's okay. It seems to me it's fine. Seems to me. I was told that there is a woman who has Haskama from Rabban Zalman Zafran Lerof, from other Gedolim, to teach other women the laws of Mizas as they were accepted in Yerushalayim. And people ask her questions, well, what do you say? Well, she gives an answer. So it seems to me that that would be permissible halakhically. Again, when it's not a piritza. And maybe in certain circles I'd be considered a priestess. And then it's not allowed for that reason. Women and Maya Macaroni. Women and men are both the same thing. By the Hasidim, the women don't wash Maya Macaroni, the men do. I once gave a public speech against the shul. It was a whole uproar. There's one shul on Earth. Everyone even was washes, but no one washes. People don't look upon very kindly that particular speech. Hasidic circles, they have two shogunaros. One for the women, one for the men. I don't understand why. Last but topic here is women's tefillah. You speak about that? Well, briefly, I don't get involved in too many polemics. But when women's tefillah first began, this goes back, I believe, more than 10 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. So, I was very, very forcefully and vocally opposed to it. I was even, once asked a question by one of the rabbonim, what do we think about it? A few of the rabbonim and the yeshiva were asked, whether the Russian yeshivas were asked, and I was one of the five who signed a piece of paper saying that we're opposed to it. Somebody dubbed us the Reitz Five. Reitz is Rabbi Yitzchak Theological Seminary. So it was going on for, oh yeah, the Reitz Five, like a whole, like I don't know, the Gang of Four, I don't know what the Reitz Five. We were dragged through the mud. Okay, again, if you sign a piece of paper, that's comes with the term. I remember that there was a group in Washington Heights, a women's tefillah. And one of the people saw that I was opposed to it, and it was someone who I knew, the family. My son was in his classmate, her son, and actually I knew her even from before. And she called and said, "Would I mind meeting with a group of the women to the Washington Heights? So I'll meet with anybody. I don't mind." So I said, "I'll tell you what. I'm in Washington Heights every day. I'll come one day and meet with you. What day? We'll pick the Sunday." And we took the Sunday. I remember it was Sunday when I was giving a bechina to my students. So the bechina was in this room, let's say, and then I would be group in the room right next door, so I could be able to, you know, pop in every once in a while to look at the Tamid and make sure they weren't doing anything dishonest, has to show them. Remember, we had those meetings book at a certain time, or at that time, they come in, 10 women, exactly. 10 women come in. Why am I opposed to the women's view? So, my recollection of this conversation, which is about 10 years old, that is a big number today, went as follows. Goes as follows. Number one, there are women's tefillah groups that are violating halacha, that are saying what we call a bracha levatola. What bracha levatola? There are certain brachas which cannot be said unless you have a quorum, a minyan, such as the bracha after laning and the brachas on the haftorah, to require a minyan. Yet, these groups, some of them, say the bracha after the laning and the bracha on the Torah, even though there are not 10 men. 10 years ago, there was no justification. In the interim, so one or two rabbis interpreted a certain source as advocating that it may be done. In my opinion, they misinterpreted that source. If I remain with my opinion, it will be a bracha levatala. And therefore, I think it's a terrible thing. But these women's prayer groups, each and every week, those that are doing it, and there are many of them now, are guilty of, let's count this up, 8, 9, 10, about 12 or 13 brachas levatala week in and week out. Just multiply that by the rule. Whenever they meet, once a week, once a month, whatever they meet. It's terrible. That's my first objection. Number two, I feel that even if women would read from the Sefer Torah without any bracha, no bracha whatsoever, I would be unhappy with it. As it stands, they do it, and they make a bracha before. A bracha before can be justified on the ground that every woman has to make a bracha before she learns Torah. I spoke about that already a month ago. But the problem is, you know how to learn before making the bracha. So how to learn before making the bracha? Well, so they ignore that. They say Shema, whatever they do in the morning before they read the Torah without a bracha, which is not allowed. Another reason why it's not allowed, really. Then they make the bracha on the lady. I'm opposed to that because, first of all, it's shtick. Gives a semblance of an aliyah. And even without that, you end up learning without a bracha, which you're not supposed to do. And beyond both of those considerations, it is establishing a new custom in a ritual matter, which I feel that we have to be very careful when these things are initiated. You think about all the ups and the downs of it, and I think the downs far outweigh the ups. But one of the women who was there said, but I enjoy very much the ability to lane. You know, to lane from the Sefer Torah. It's a challenge. It gives me an opportunity to demonstrate my skills as in Tamei HaMikra and in Diktuk, and in, you know, I can master this very difficult beginning of Kriyas HaTorah. So I said, if you really feel you must read the Torah in public, so get a tikkun, which is basically a folder style of the same Torah. And read from that. Is that a problem? No, but I want you to be from a Sefer Torah. Ah, not to say you want to develop the skills. You want to be from a Sefer Torah. Because you want to have the Kriyas HaTorah in the same format as the man as much as possible. That's me too, is it? They call wannabes today, the term wannabes. So I don't think that's appropriate. Yes?
Along the same line, what about saving men having a
Well, I'm very much against that for two reasons. One is Barov Om Hadrasmela. They're supposed to unite the community as much as possible as one, not as two. Now, there is another consideration, I wish I was the first to admit in that respect. And that is, something in the shul is so zoo. You can't hear anything. That's true even for a shul on Shabbos. You don't have to be better for it. That was one of the rabbanim who certainly means a very sincere rabbi. 10 years ago, didn't understand what's wrong with the women's tefillah. They come to shul and everyone's talking. They come in and no one talks. That's a shame. But the response to that is not that the women should start their own tefillah. The men should stop talking, or the women should stop talking in the regular shul. Or let men and women establish a separate shul where they're not going to talk. The woman doesn't. I don't want any talking in the shul. I can't hear anything. Let. Whenever a number of women are in that cataract, with their husbands, so they can control their husbands a little bit, they wear out in a minion with no talking whatsoever. 20 men and 20 women, or whatever it may be, and have a regular minion, which is quiet. That's the solution to the problem. Not having a separate secessionist women's minion. That was one reason I'm opposed. The second reason, which came to pass, first thing you know, the women will read the Megillah for themselves. Next thing you know, which happened already, the women ended up reading the Megillah for men. Which according to one opinion of the Shulchan Aruch is a no-no. Now how to do it. You're not Kol Isha. That's the Kol Isha aspect. But you're not, you don't fulfill the mitzvah because the woman's obligation is not the same at a higher level as the men's obligation. For reasons which are, it's a long story. I don't want to look for it right now. And I don't know. Different kind of Kriya or Shmir. It's a long, long discussion. It really doesn't belong in this class, right? I don't think it belongs here. If you want, I can go into it. But it's a different level. But sure enough, start with one thing and then to another. Once you break through that fence, it's hard to stop yourself later on. The proof that happened. But then, after having said all these things, these two objections, that they're absolute violations of halacha, and semi-violations, or violations of the spirit, things of this nature, I came to my third objection. And the third objection was that at that point in time, and I really can't speak for right now, I'm a little bit out of the loop right now, not following so carefully, but certainly at that time when it was initiated, this whole movement, I don't think movement is a proper word over here, but this movement was initiated, it was done with a very significant input from individuals who I felt were not sincere. Someone came to me and thought, what a chutzpah you have. You're being judgmental. How can you evaluate people's motives? I said, that's my job. I'm judgmental every single day of the week. What do you think a judge is? A judge is judgmental. A judge is always judging, are you honest or dishonest? He looks you in the eye and then he has to figure out if he's telling the truth or not. That's ridiculous criticism. I'm being judgmental. Of course I'm being judgmental. That's the job of every Roman person and die. You have to be judgmental. You're a judge, you have to be judgmental. And I felt, knowing some of the individuals, either personally or by reputation, knowing some of their educational affiliation, which included a large number of people who were involved in the Jewish Theological Seminary, and individuals who had espoused views which I felt were not in keeping with the Torah's halacha and hashkafa, in other areas, I'll do with this, I felt that this association of these individuals with this movement rendered the entire movement suspect. So even those women who came to me, who I looking at them being judgmental, I thought they really were sincere, the ones who came to listen to me. But nevertheless, since the movement was being spearheaded, and I think still is, by individuals who are not so sincere, and who have an axe to grind, and are involved in general feminism, and have advocated positions to go way beyond the halacha. The fact that they too are involved in this movement in its forefront, to me, renders the entire movement something which should be avoided. That's what I said 10 years ago. I really haven't changed my mind. I'm usually very consistent. Usually, sometimes things change. But I haven't changed this matter in 10 years. I don't know, I don't talk about it too often, because I want to make a fight. I already made my point. The other Rabbanu came out and said what they had to say. Some would listen, some don't listen. Like anything else. Once I'm getting a little excited, I have to tell you that Hama Vassar came uptown and I'm upset about something else. They criticized what I wrote. That doesn't bother me too much. But somebody criticized what I said, not quoting me. Somebody criticized our basic thesis of this entire course, which we spent weeks developing at the very beginning. It was quoted and attributed, I should say, to a man named Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, Kvod Rav, a great, tremendous, tremendous person. I'm very happy to be criticized indirectly in his company. I consider him to be a very great man. And apparently he wrote some in one of his books about the different roles for men and for women, and I don't know if that's what he said. I spent a lot of time talking about it. And somebody wrote a letter, or wrote an article in this current issue which came out today, saying it's a bunch of bunk. It's apologetic, it's this, it's insincere, it's dishonest. Let's face it, the Torah looks down on women. The Torah considers women to be secondary, second rate. Let's face it. And what do you expect from the Torah? The Torah was given in a time of paganism, a time of culturally backward people. So what do you expect from the Torah? You know, I don't like to be overly critical, but that line of reasoning, it seems to me, is, I don't know, I don't want to use the word, but maybe too strong. We believe the Torah is written by God, not by Moses. So if you say, well, Moses was a product of his time. True. Because God is for all time. So, either you believe, as one of the suggestions, which is reported in the article, that we're all off the wall, if God decided that women are secondary, so that's true, and modern sensibilities are all wrong. That's what he called that the right-wing position. Okay, that's not heresy. And I don't like it. But at least it attributes the correct position to the Lord. The Lord is correct, and the modern man is wrong. Okay, that I can hack. But the other way around, I don't think that's a compatible position in the perspective of a Jewish thought. Beyond the pale. You'll see it. You can't miss it. So, I got to unburden myself a little bit. If you have any questions, I'll take them now. I'd love to go into the Evanez. I can also pass it around if you want to have more suggestions. Yes?
I don't think that we covered this. Did you mention that Kiddush
Levana?
I don't know if it's like...
No, I don't think we discussed
Kiddush Levana. Is it allowed?
Interesting. That's a very interesting point you raised. Some say that women are obligated to Kiddush Levana. Most say that they're exempt from Kiddush Levana. Some say they're not allowed to do Kiddush Levana. Not allowed has to be based on something which is beyond us. It's based on the what we call Nistar, the hidden. Now, hidden, you're not required to know what's hidden. You're only required to know what's revealed. So to make an absolute prohibition, I would not do, unless, once again, as people are doing it, because they say, we refuse to accept an exemption. We insist on doing it, etc., etc. If a woman's in the Kiddush Levana, because she feels that she'd like to be strict and be machmir, the opinion which says that it should be done, she likes to follow all the chumras, not just this chumras, all the chumras, right? Then, I wouldn't oppose. The same as I wouldn't oppose a woman who wants to bench a mezuzah because she holds like a Vilna Gaon. So there's an obligation. If she holds all the stringency of the Vilna Gaon, including this one, more power to her. If she's only going to pick the stringency which are on the feminist agenda, if you will, for lack of a better term, then I don't buy it. Okay? Any more questions before we open up the new book? Yeah.
You mentioned necklines very quickly.
Yes, yes.
Some people ask for a halachic basis for what has to be covered, what doesn't have to be covered.
Again, the neck can be revealed, but the body itself should not. The way you can do is draw a line between the neck and the body. So, professor of anatomy. Anatomy is something else. Approximately enough. Is that the place? Collarbone is really pushing it, but okay, but not beyond. Collarbone is pretty far. It seems to me if a woman would reveal everything up until the collarbone, I'd be a little bit uncomfortable. A little bit. Prohibition, absolutely. But I'm going to take a test. Yeah, want to go next door? I'm sorry. Okay. Can we go back to the Shulchan Aruch now? Yeah. And I mean, it seems to me that there should be one Shulchan Aruch. Ideally, the Shulchan Aruch should be one, should be unified for the house. Ideally, either they both use Baruch or both don't. That's what seems to me should be the proper way to do things. I can't. I know what am I going to say? Men do it, women don't. What am I going to do about it? I remember once I had a discussion about it. I'll tell you a fascinating conversation. This conversation goes back 13 years. I was learning Hilchos Shabbos at the time. So, Shulchan Aruch, there's Shulchan Aruch, there's Posen the Rambam. You have to be mechallel Shabbos to save the life of a person whose life is in danger, you should not do it either through minors or through women, but it should be done by what he calls the Gedolei Yisroel. So I said that the reason for this is because undoubtedly in those days gone by, that they were treated women, Rambam said, they treated women somehow as, thank you very much, as somehow they weren't as obligated. And there was a fear that if a woman would be asked to do the Chal Shabbos to save the Chola, that one of two things. Either the next time the man wouldn't do it himself, he'd look around for a woman, the first patient would die when he finds a woman. Or, one might suggest, that the woman might take liberties. Hey, if I can drive the car to the hospital and my husband can't do it, then why can I drive to the store? I mean, to the shul, my husband can't do it. That's how it says. But that wouldn't apply nowadays, don't tell my conversationalist. I come from Muncie, the rabbi said. I come from Muncie. And in Muncie, in many homes, there's a question, I want to open up a can on Shabbos. So the man says, why can you open a can? You get the Shabbos shiksa for him. Well, that's right. Well, so what's one step away from my corner, right? It's really, there's nothing distinguishing about it. Some say, I open a can. I feel that either in the house everyone opens cans or no one opens cans. I think that's the ideal. See, I make a distinction between a case in which the Balabas accepts the stringency on himself. The Balabas won't eat Chodesh. Let me give an example. He won't eat Chodesh, but everyone in the house except him eats Chodesh. That doesn't bother me so much. He eats a Rav, he eats a Rosh Hashiva, he eats a big Tzaddik, but if his son doesn't eat Chodesh and his wife does, that bothers me. Little pipsqueak was 13, oh, and he has to accept all the chumras. And the wife, well, she can eat any, you know, not that bothered. That's very crucial malarus, which a male, female, I don't accept that. Alright? I want to make myself clear. Well, there's one reason. There are two reasons. One reason is the salt, in which case it doesn't apply nowadays, because we don't have that salt. That's like admitting of Mogan Abram. Another say it's based on washing your hands for covering the bench, you're going to do it so, or stop, or other reasons you don't know about. But they're both legitimate positions. They're both legitimate positions, but it shouldn't split, in my opinion. Okay, back to Siman Aleph, okay? Got delayed quite a bit, but alright, it's important discussion we have. There's an obligation of Pru Ravu. Interestingly, the obligation of Pru Ravu is incumbent upon a man, not upon the woman. Now, of course, we understand very well that a man cannot fulfill Pru Ravu without a woman. I think that everyone realizes that. A question could be raised, why is it limited to a man? Did we discuss that? I don't think so. Why? The answer, I don't know. It's based on the pasuk, b'chivshua, b'chivshua, it's a pasuk. But if you want to get logic, I'll tell you two insights of the Sefer Meshech Chochma. Why a man is obligated and not a woman. Just two reasons. One is that childbirth is dangerous. So in the old days, it was very dangerous. And the Torah did not feel it proper to obligate someone to do something which is dangerous. Obviously, a woman gets married and she has a child, it's going to be just as dangerous even though she's not obligated. Yeah, but we didn't tell her she had to do it. She wanted to get married. She wanted to have a child. The Torah didn't want to make an incumbent and mandatory since it was dangerous. That's reason number one. Reason number two is even more fascinating. The Torah is very much against divorce. Divorce is a tragedy. We know all too well about a tragedy of divorces. Today's world, divorce rate has skyrocketed compared to 35 years ago. 35 years ago when I was I just give it as a benchmark of my mind. I moved to Queens 35 years ago. Almost 37 years ago. Getting older. We down in the big shul. Remember the big, major, huge shul with hundreds and hundreds of members. And we were whispering. One couple that before. That was it. One. Now, unfortunately, the it's so commonplace that in the just a sign of the times. In the camp which I attend, Rosh Hashanah, they have on the application for these for the campers, they have on the you know the application for every single camper. They say no, I don't know how it goes. It says name of father, that's the name of mother. Then the whole our parents divorce. You have to write down no. You might as well ask a question. So some write no Baruch Hashem. Or some just leave it blank, they don't want to discuss it. But all too often the answer is yes. All too often. Otherwise it wouldn't be in the application, right? They can't get getting killed. Caught between it, no, they weren't prepared, they were blindsided. All of a sudden the father calls, the mother calls, do this, but that's stuck. But they had to prepare themselves by putting this in the application. Sign of the times. Terrible. The Torah is against divorce. Now, what will happen if a woman marries a man and they're married for a significant period of time and no children? Terrible. It's very sad. We all know cases like it's very sad. Now, the woman is required, if I told her to have children, she has to tell her husband, listen, I love you very much, but look, the Torah's going to have children, and with you I can't have children, maybe it's because of you, I don't know, they're going to have tests to know they're going after them. So we have to get a divorce. Oy. So tragic. So to avoid this tragedy, the Torah says to a woman, you're not required to have children. Patient. However, the man is obligated to have children, it is true. He's married to his wife, called Eretz Shavarot, for 10 years. And they don't have not blessed with children. Shulchan Aruch is required to do what he can to make sure that he has children. What can he do? So by Torah law, guess what he can do? That's right. Take another wife. No need for a divorce. So therefore, the Torah could obligate the man without concern that it may lead to a divorce. These women who cannot be married to two men, as we all know, The Torah removed the obligation to avoid the problem of divorce. Now why is this such a significant point that he makes? In my opinion, if his point is correct, if it's only a theory, no matter how great the man is, he was a great man, but it's only a theory. If his point is correct, what should emerge is that nowadays, if a couple cannot have children after 10 years, there's no obligation to have a divorce. Second wife, you can't do. We assume both sons. Even if it's a matter of having children, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom against bigamy still applies. That's really customary. We never heard of anyone these days take a second wife in order to have children. So they have the two choices: are either divorce or remain childless. So the minig is today, what do the people remain childless? How can it be? It's against the din, against the mishnah, against the gemara, against the shulchan aruch. How can it be? So one could at least theorize that the Rabbeinu Gershom's ban against polygamy was introduced. So then the Torah may say, look, we're against divorce. But all this is, I'm not passing the shadow there now. Just talking about the theory. Okay. This is the obligation of Pururu. Anyone who does not involve himself in Pururu is a terrible thing. It's like murder. Not bringing someone into the world is like taking someone out of the world. Now, obviously not the same thing, but the same type of thing. And someone who's not married, a man who's not married, is without bracha, without Torah. He's not called a man. And once he marries, all of his sins are removed. Wow, this is better than being married. He can sell a sacred Torah to get married. And if you get married at 18, and if you get married at 13, it's even better. Mitzvah ben amufar. It's the first picture. They used to say to the, they quote this from various rabbonim. There was a question, who should get mafter? There was a bar mitzvah and there was a chosn. So the Rebbe said, whoever's older. They used to get married before 13, and it's not really a lot of marriage, they did it. Talmud Tos, they did it. believe it or not, yeah, because I'm afraid of the goyim would come, who knows what.
Yeah.
Fascinating comment here in the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon says, the Shulchan Aruch says, Kaya called Adam Lisa Isha Kedelifros Velirbos. A man should marry a woman in order to have children. Why do you put in the reasons that wanted to have children? He shouldn't marry for an ulterior motive. And he quotes the famous passage at the end of the Sechas Tanis. Remember the famous Tuba of, you know that one? Somebody asked me a question, how can it be that women can't dance in front of the men? He said, what do you mean? He said, Tana, they used to all dance at Tuba of. My response to it is that that's for the purpose of marriage. It's like you're not allowed to look at a woman for the purpose of marriage. It's allowed. So I guess they weren't dancing to a rock beat, whatever they were doing. You were allowed to look at a woman in order for the purpose of marriage. So different people say different things. The beautiful women said, look at me. Sheisha Leofi. All this reviewed. The rich one said, listen. Even if I'm not so good looking, you'll give me makeup and jewelry. And each other takshitim, woman for jewelry. But we don't pass like either of those. Was Esther pretty or not? So what do you say? Come on, you must learn when you were in school. Was Esther pretty or Esther was not pretty? What do you say, huh? Green. It was not green, it was probably meant yellow. You're right, remember she was yellow, she had a yellow complexion. She's not considered pretty in those days. She wasn't so beautiful. But it says in the Megillah, but T. Esther, no says chain, Bene Koroel. So the Vilna Gaon says, no, Yofi is intrinsic beauty. Chain is charm, or something else is. Isha Yiras Hashem Mitisalo, the chain will be open. If it's one, she is an Isha Yiras Hashem, and she's obviously praying for her Yiras. Isha Yiras Hashem Mitisalal, the chain will be open. If it's one, she's an Isha Yiras Hashem, and she's fully, obviously praying for her Yiras Hashem. That's not what it is. No! Once she's a Yiras Hashem, you pray even for a chain and yofi. If it's a chain and yofi without Yiras Hashem, then it's nothing. Incidentally, I can't resist telling you what the Prussian books of the Vilna Gaon, that Avraham Avinu said to Sarah, you must know from Chumash and Rashi, Hinei no yodati ki isha yafas mara ot. I know that you're a beautiful woman. So I'm going to ask the question, what do you mean? He didn't know before that? So, well, I've never looked at his wife. I don't know. He never looked at his wife. I mean, what does that mean? Well, I think it means what they quote from the Vilna Gaon. He knew his wife was absolutely stunning. He wasn't blind, I remember. He looked at his thing. He knew that she was absolutely stunning. He wasn't sure of one thing. Was it intrinsic beauty? Or maybe she was always put together. She always, makeup and jewelry and clothing and this and that. Maybe she just, he just wasn't exactly sure what it was. Was it intrinsic or not? So, how can you tell? Usually, he could have thought, Sarah wanted to make herself beautiful, and she succeeded, but she wasn't intrinsically beautiful. But when they came down to Mitzrayim, there was a fear that she would be taken by Paro, as she indeed was. So then the obvious thing to do would be to make yourself look not so beautiful. So I guess Sarah made a try, and it didn't work. But she was stunning intrinsically. That's what it means. Hine no yodati ki isha yufas mara'a. Till I thought maybe we were balas kei. Nice, it's yofi, it's not pain. That's an interesting interpretation. Cain and yofi. In the opening page in Ebenezer. Should a man get married at 18 today, in my opinion? Absolutely not. 18-year-olds are not mature enough to get married, as a rule. Now, everyone has exceptions. Someone I know got married at 17. Family was a little bit nervous. Baruch Hashem. Should I say now? 12 years and I think 6 children later, the things are doing okay. Baruch Hashem. But that's an exception. I wouldn't recommend it as a rule. How long should a young man wait till he gets married? He's ready. When is he ready? Don't ask me. If I know him, maybe I can offer a suggestion whether he's ready or not. Is he mature? Is he stable? Does he know what he's doing? Someone who's learning Torah has a right to postpone his marriage somewhat. What is the obligation of Puruhu? Is to have one boy and one girl. While themselves healthy, produce their own children. I should add a very important point. Marriage is important even beyond the context of school rule, very important. Let's say a man married, had children, lost his wife, or the woman lost her husband. Now they're older, beyond childbearing age. They are still supposed to get married. Lo tov heyo sa'odom levado. Married and has a boy and a girl, does that mean that's it? That's it, the nuclear family. Alright? One boy, one girl, that's it. Well, as far as the basic minimum mitzvah for a who, that is it.
Sure.
However, we are taught that a person is supposed to have children beyond the boy and the girl. Shulchanov tells us the man fulfilled Puru Ravu and lost his wife or divorced, he's required to marry a woman who can still have more children. Some say you can even sell a sefer Torah in order to marry a woman who is childbearing as opposed to one who is not. That's a matter of dispute. You see how significant having children beyond the boy and girl is. Yes?
If a man marries and has children and then is either widowed or divorced, can he then marry someone who is unable to have children?
So that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that he really should marry a woman in order to have more children. But if he can't afford it, and there's a dispute with you, would you sell the Sefer Torah or not? Shulchan Ramah goes as far and says that if he has many children already, and he's afraid that if he will marry a woman who can have children, he'll have more children now from the second wife, there will be, quote, kitatos tulurivos menas vanu menishta, there'll be fight between his new wife with her new children and his children from the first wife, then it's permissible to marry a woman who cannot have children. But to stay unmarried completely is not allowed. Even though the new mother, the new wife mates, I'm not getting along so well with the children of the first wife. Too bad. You can't. The man not supposed to be without a wife. So we see therefore that if having more children than of course Kutatus and Narivas fights, then there's a reason to perhaps not have so many more children. What could extend this? Not only the fight between his second wife and his children to the first wife, but a fight with his present wife. He had only one wife. And she says to him, listen, my dear husband, I'm not a baby machine. I'm not interested in having any more children. That's it. And I don't want any more. So if he insists to take her to the rock, the entire world, she has to agree to have more children. So we call that Kutatus and Narivas. That's a fight. So, if the woman can be convinced, persuaded, cajoled, bribed, that it's a good idea for her to have more children, okay. But if not, then not. That's what seems over here in the Ramon. What's he going to do? Going to divorce her and marry her second wife because she doesn't want to have as many children as she wants to have? I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's right at all. The woman has to understand from her own perspective that that having a large family is something which is a very positive contribution to Klal Yisrael. And ultimately it's a contribution to her own fulfillment. But at the time when she's so harried and hassled and fatigued and impatient and under such stress, she says, I can't imagine myself having another child right now. So if the circumstances would corroborate her claim, and I think that she's right. That's not a very frum position, I know that. Today, in the frum world, that would be considered heresy. That's a child. But, my opinion in this matter is that if the woman wants to bear the child and raise the child, she should be the one who determines whether it should be the child. And especially since her physical health be compromised, her emotional health could be compromised, she has the last word in my opinion. I should add, boy, I let this pass. This is only true if they already had a child. The couple gets married and had a child, and they had a child, the woman now is under stress from having the child. But if the couple wants to start off their marriage with various methods, if I may, which are intended to avoid having children, I am a fierce opponent of this practice. And I mean fierce. is terrible. It goes against the whole concept of Jewish marriage. You got the halachas of this and how they're going to do it, the problem of potential averus. But whatever, it just goes against. Shulchan Aruch says that when a couple gets married, man is required to fulfill puruvu. He's supposed to do whatever he can in order to fulfill the puruvu, not to try to avoid having the children by various means. So, if you already fulfilled puruvu, they had a son and a daughter, and now they want to avoid it by... The closest thing I can call it is the rhythm method, as it's called, according to the quarter of the year, the Shulchan Aruch. Then, okay. Then there's a basis for it. They haven't fulfilled puruvu yet. That is a very big question. If they haven't had a child at all yet, it's a much bigger question. If they had a child, so many rabbanim feel that a woman is entitled to have a break after every child. You know, in the olden days, the woman would nurse. The nurse would last for 2 years solid. And for those 2 years, she wouldn't become pregnant. That was how the teva was in those days. They wouldn't become pregnant while they were nursing. They didn't give bottles, baby food, and beach stuff, and all that. It was a complete nursing job for 2 years. So she wouldn't have a child more, figure it out, more than once every 2 3/4 years. Now that's what I call spacing. Some of them feel that nowadays if she's not nursing, the nursing is no longer the contraceptive, she's allowed to space her children by the same amount of time. I think it's a pretty reasonable sum, if the woman requires that amount. She may not. She may say, I'm willing to have a baby become pregnant a month after my child was born. Good luck. I'm not opposed to it. Great. She likely won't become pregnant, depending on what she's going to say. That's this, that's that. It's time for your cheshbonis. One of the problems I have with the modern way of thinking, and as it has impact on the Orthodox community, that in many circles there are women who wish to postpone childbearing, and even postpone marriage, for the purpose of a career. And while I'm not against careers, I've told you explicitly, I'm against the career limiting family size. Now, I'm saying this with the realization that in the circles in which we find ourselves, here if there's no career, not so likely they're going to be 14 children. So, therefore, whatever number of children could have existed without the career can probably exist even with the career, if you want to be able to juggle a little bit. Therefore, not against careers. Some careers are harder than others. This currently, very time-consuming careers. Problematic. Yeah, there are women who do it anyway. What do they call superwoman? Okay. Revolver. Every person's in that category. The entire modernist approach, we'll get married and we'll postpone having children until we feel like we're ready for it. Just sort of, you know, we'll postpone it for a month, and then 6 months, and a year, and 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Till I finish my next degree. Till I can make a living. Till I... And it's anti-Torah, in my opinion. On the other hand, the woman is just felt she's had it, she can't have any more children. Then I feel even though it has been not been through a removal, if that's her desire based on the fact that she's right, then she carries the day. I have a Talmud who has 5 daughters. If every daughter was born, Rebbe. I have to look for yet. The wife says, yeah, but I... but each time I said she was right. He's being frum. Being frum on her back. Once there is a green light given by a reliable stock that they really are not required to have children because of the woman's physical state or emotional state, as the case may be, then the question becomes, well, how do you avoid having children? We mentioned, well, the rhythm method. It doesn't work. It used to be a joke, what do you call people who use the rhythm method? And the answer was, parents. Especially in the Chalukis Tars of Mishpacha, it's very difficult to not even know what. So there are various means, without going into every death, prat to prat. But if you don't hear it here, I mean, it may sound a little bit unseemly to go into it, but I don't have no choice. There are various methods which are advocated by physicians nowadays. One is what they call the pill. It's been around for a while, right? Birth control pill contraception. If a physician considers it to be acceptable, then to the Rabbanim it's also acceptable. Again, except in the circumstance when not having children is itself an acceptable alternative or option. How do you go about it? So to use these pills, it seems to me, would be acceptable under these conditions. Watch out, some of these pills are called stains. Depending on the problem of Taras and Mishpacha. Sometimes the pills cause staining, breaks through bleeding, all kinds of other things like this. And then, it leads to the best method of birth control, called abstinence. You have to be very careful with these pills. The high dose and low dose, the low dose is healthier, but the low dose causes staining. I'm not going into the medicine right now, just be aware. And I guess I should tell you now, we haven't started talking about marriage yet, so this is the first siman, that there are many women nowadays who, as a matter of course, they take these kinds of pills to regulate the cycle in advance of their chasana. It should be a chupas nidah. I don't like it. I've had too many cases that because of these pills it became a chupas nidah. Staining and this and that. My opinion of this matter is that there should be a short engagement. That's number one. We spoke about before. Short engagement. So you can try to time it. It should be at the proper time of the month when the wedding should be. It's more important than which caterer you use, or which day of the week it's on, you know. If something goes wrong, which can happen, a woman before class that can have all kinds of changes, hormonal swings, and this and that, if you get early, you get late, anything can happen. So then, when it gets closer to the event, when I say I have nothing to lose, then I say, okay, so use certain pills, and hope that it'll work. But to go on the pills for 6 months in advance of the wedding, and when a person is engaged, I don't think it's right. It could cause problems rather than solve it. It could be potentially completely unnecessary. And P.S., when you get off it, it could make your system haywire. And I know all these things, not from Ruach HaKodesh, but from the questions that I've received. Numerous occasions. So this is one method which is considered acceptable under these circumstances. What other methods are used nowadays? Well, the worst method of all is one that's most commonly advised, but it's called the condom. Man uses a condom as what's called an Isser of Otsoa Zerah Levatola. Spoke about the first week, right? So we have one method which is acceptable, and one is prohibited. What's in the middle? Well, basically divides into two other methods. One of them is called an IUD, very popular case, a uterine device. In my opinion, according to halacha, it's mutter. But there are problems. I'm not a fan of its use on a widespread basis because two things. One, it also can cause staining. And two, chas v'chalila, in a rare case, it could cause infection, which could have very bad consequences. Maybe it could impossible have children later on. I know it's remote, but still, I'm probably taking my responsibility to advocate this. The people who I know who have done it have lived to tell the tale and have had children subsequently. Obviously, it's not a very, a thing happens all the time. I never face it. No one's no doctor would do it, but it's a very capable physician if you're using this method. And this leaves us with the very commonly used barrier method. Diaphragm, ooh, I left something out. Something called spermicides. Just by themselves, spermicide. That's, I believe, permissible. But once again, it doesn't always work. And I think they say it's 70% effective. Do the math and you'll figure out that it's 70% effective. It works most of the time, but... And it's a barrier method. Diaphragm, they have this called sponges, all different types. This is a major, major machlokes. Whoa. This is a big, big dispute. Some say this is terrible. It's like a, almost like a condom because it's the zera of the husband does not cannot enter into the uterus, so it's a terrible thing. Others say no. Not so bad. Number one, they say, if you look at the Talmudic source which talk about what they call moch. Moch was cotton. That was the old style contraceptive. The woman would fill the whole cavity with cotton, which would absorb the whole all the zera and nothing could get in, and that was the end. Even moch itself is a subject of great disputes among the commentaries. Many poskim say that moch is permissible. Whenever they're allowed not to have children, whatever external reason. Health. Life. And then there are those who claim that even if moch is prohibited, this is not moch. Moch was very intrusive. It was a big pack of cotton that would be inserted just to block out the whole area. And the zera would go directly onto it, as opposed to these diaphragms of sponge which are inserted very high up in the cervix. And it's not the same. The proof is that no one will advocate you should use a diaphragm by itself. They will tell you to use it together with spermicide. Because the diaphragm by itself is so high up and far removed that if the diaphragm will later on come out, there I could still swim up and cause a pregnancy. So we see it's not exactly the same as Moch. Moch was locked up everything, just took it out and that was the end. So there are various, again, I'm not coming to give a definitive psak, but I think my personal opinion is that these methods are all acceptable when contraception is acceptable in the first place. Which is, as I said before, not at the beginning of the marriage, in my opinion, nor when it's for the purposes of advancing careers or saving money. If you pay off money. If you worry about money, you can't afford to have any children. That's a fact. Now really, a child they had it in the papers, a child cost $1.something million to raise to the age of 21. That's without yeshiva tuition. You can't afford any children. We know that consideration, basically. That's going to be so bad that it caused Tuntus and Merivus. It caused fighting and tension and stress. A woman has to keep cool. My opinion, a woman who's cool could have more children. A woman who's stressed out, have to watch out. Everybody is cool, right? Everyone's cool? People pride themselves on being cool. So. Siman Aleph, which includes the Chayav of Rabbeinu Gershom, not to marry his second wife. Siman Beis is fascinating. marry a woman who is not allowed to marry? Then the Rambam says, whoever married a woman who was disqualified, was puzzled, was mishum mamon, because she's rich, is punished with bonin she'ena mehugonin, with children that are not, don't come out right. But if there is no halakhic impediment, even though he marries her for her money, mutter. So writes the Rambam. The Vilna Gaon disagrees. Nothing to do with it. You're not supposed to marry a woman for her money under any conditions. Is that right? Only thing is, if you were to marry her anyway, and she happens to have money, all right. Not so bad. Remember one of the fellas, Kibbutz, goes back 25 years ago, he said, marry for money? Chas v'shalom. But how can you not love a girl who has so much money? I can tell you how. I recommend strongly not to marry for money. According to the Vilna Gaon, it's an absolute halacha. Even according to the Rambam, I've seen too many stories, too many heartbreakers. If he or she happens to be rich, you have to make your own judgment in your mind, are you marrying for money or not? Be true to yourself. The new machla, I mean, I don't know, new or old, the yeshiva bachas have a price on their head. I'm serious, I'm not kidding around. She would have a price on their head. Not new. Yeah, I remember when I was single, I had a price on my head. I got a phone call in the yeshiva, somewhat to make a certain shit of arrangement, and you know what? This guy. X dollars. Hung up the phone. I wasn't interested at all. I wasn't hearing anything. Forget about it. But you know, now a certain yeshiva became something which is. We desired. Why? Not chas v'shalom because we want money. Oh, no, that's very base. Because you want to learn. And you can't learn without money. If you want to learn, you can't learn without money, so you have to have a price tag. And the better you are, the buffer, you know, and then reputation-wise, whatever your resume says, that's what it's risk. In Lakewood, you know, there's a certain route that has to be taken. So then the price tag gets higher. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to critical, I'm not sure, so all the ins and the outs, but I can tell you many sad stories which result from this. On the other hand, I have to once again, I'm reminded of what that, the article said, the one that, the letter which was against what I said. I wrote there against the Torah youth groups. The correspondent writes, what do you mean? How can you be against co-ed youth groups? Do you know what goes on in the quote right wing world where they don't have these co-ed activities? And look how terrible the marriages are. Look how many divorces that they have. This man is wearing his eyes. I don't know what he's thinking. Do the statistics. Do the statistics. See what the divorce rate is in the quote right wing world. Were they not involved in co-education activities when they're teenagers? And do the statistics for the group that is involved in these co-education activities. It's not even close. It's not even close. There's so many more divorces from Rahman al-Islam in the group than in the quote modern group. With all their, you know, they're used to women, you know, they went to school with them, and they went to camp with them, and they went to shul with them, and they went to live with them. And they still get divorced 5 times as much as these Lakewood and Beis Yaakov people. It's a fact. And when they marry in Lakewood, they're sacrificed not for money. Their record's even better. So I'm very upset about this. I think it's just not consistent with the facts. When I used to teach these, now I teach boys in the yeshiva who are older, so now they're ready to go out, they're married. When I taught the younger ones, and they were 17 or something like that, they would say, Rebbe, but we have to become cool. Yeah, we have to develop our social skills. You tell us we shouldn't go out now until we're ready to get married. Why would that? How are we gonna do it? So I looked at them, I said, boys. Tried to do girls too, but I said, boys. Either you got it or you don't got it. If you got it, you'll get it. You'll start going out at 22, it'll be no problem. If you don't got it, all the training at 16, 17, 18 is not going to help you one day. There's a slight overstatement, but not much. Not much. So what does one look for in marriage? Oh, you're not looking for money, you're not looking for beauty, you're not looking for what are you looking for? So the Shulchan Aruch says, you look for mishpacha. Right, the Torah says, look for mishpacha, look for family. When I was younger, I thought that family was much overplayed as a role in looking for a marriage partner. Oh, come on, you put your stand on his or her own 2 feet, who cares about the family, and not in the person. As I get older, maybe a little wiser from experience, I think that Chazal, as always, are on target. And the family plays a tremendous role in the background and the very essence of the person. It's not to say that someone who's not coming from a wonderful family is not entitled to happiness in life and should find a proper marriage partner, Chas v'Shalom. I'm not saying that a Chas v'Shalom would be a terrible thing to say. But all the things being equal, you know, a person shouldn't marry out of pity. You don't marry a boy because, well, he comes from a family which is a problem, but I want to look at him, look what he did. He, despite the shortcoming, he still is a fine fellow. Careful with that kind of reasoning. And forgive me if it sounds strange, but I say it like I think it. To my mind, the most important element to look for in seeking a marriage partner is a common background. Common background means common concepts, common memories. You grew up the same way, whatever that may be. If you're above a chassid, you're better off marrying above a chassid. I mean, that's if you have the same rebbe, with the same concepts, the same everything. And if your family is a Shivish, is a marathon who goes to Shivish. A little bit more modern, so it's kind of the same way. As close as you can get in the background, I think that's the best thing. Only because it just, you accept things the same way, you have to start learning new ways of life. Remember some of my family would complain, how come it is that the rich marry the rich? I think it's correct. The rich should marry the rich, because they used to it. You know, so she's rich, they work the same way, so otherwise, with an imbalance, it could cause something, it could cause problems. The poor marry the poor, you know, after the older better, the children marry each other. They used to the same thing. They call the father at midnight, and then the fishbowl and all that kind of stuff. They used to it. They grew up in a rabbi's house. Yeah, so you know. They used to it. Yes.
I just was curious what your comment would be in terms of the whole college football movement and the whole kind of coming out. So what would be your perspective about that?
I certainly feel very strongly that someone who is what they call today, this is a colloquialism, Baal Tshuva. They're the real tzaddik. I wish we Baal Tshuva. But that's for the lack, I don't want to fight City Hall. Everyone calls them a Baal Tshuva, BT, so I can't fight it. So we'll call them that. We'll Chozer in B'Tshuva. That's which is used now, but they want to call Baal Tshuva. I don't know all the vocabulary. You know, it seems to me that it might be more appropriate, according to what I'm saying, that if he's a Baal Tshuva, he may find it easier for the Baal Tshuva. But it has to be that way. I'm not saying Khalil divide Baal into two. But my opinion about what I called before commonality, it should be common background, would indicate that that would be something to consider. Not as a, none of these things are absolutes. Not a lila v'chas, you should take it as an absolute. Grooming out. So if he froms out and she froms out, it's a perfect shidduch. Well, let's work hard. And I'll make sure it's kosher. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.